Legal Matters.
Indeed, Mthokozisi Maphumulo is my guest, senior associate at Adams & Adams, joins me now. Mtho, good evening to you, and thank you so much for joining me, my brother. Are you well?
It will be a bit of exaggeration to say I'm well, Aubrey, and to the listeners.
I hear you, man.
Debt shedding, unemployment, fewer hikes, children losing lives at the province. How do you say you are well?
It's a lot, brother. It's a lot. And indeed, we are going to need strength. We're going to need strength in the times ahead of us. But tonight you and I are going to be speaking about certain legal principles, particularly as it pertains to sports injuries, fatalities, and so forth. Not too long ago, we saw the very sad story of a young boxer who, it appears, had a stroke while he was fighting. In fact, this young guy looked like he was winning the fight. Remember the story? I forget what his name is. He looked like he was winning the fight. And when he had knocked out his opponent, the referee stopped the fight to check whether the opponent was okay. And then when the fight was supposed to start again, the young man was starting to punch the air, clearly disorientated, and it's clear that now he has passed on, but because of a stroke. That story comes to mind, and many other stories in the rugby field, people who are injured as a result of the nature of the sport. It's a full contact sport. On the soccer field, I mean, all sorts of sports where people get injured. What is the departure point? How do we even, from a legal point of view, who do we blame for somebody who is injured in a sport where they voluntarily joined to play and an accident takes place there? How do we even couch that in our minds? Who's to blame?
Sure. So that's a very good question, Aubrey. So with these kinds of injuries, we really ever hardly find cases or court cases or cases that actually go to court. And those that do really do not stand a good chance of success. And there is a very good reason for that. And to start with, that is because, as you've pointed out, to say they voluntarily enter into these sporting codes, knowing very well, especially with the contact sports, particularly boxing, wrestling, and you may want to also add rugby and karate, et cetera, et cetera. Those sports, by their very nature, there is a probability of contact. In fact, there is the absolute possibility that there is going to be contact. So it comes, well, the reason why the court cases remain extremely minimal is because of the legal consent that is given by the participants to the sporting codes.
So I mean, give me a practical understanding, Tor. I go and I fight in a fight, and I am injured there, much like in the case of that young man I was talking about. Who's to blame? Who's liable?
There's absolutely no one. Well, based on what we saw, of course, someone else may want to closely scrutinize the incident. But from what we saw and what we've been reading in the papers and seeing how that actual fight has kind of really negatively impacted on the other participant in terms of their emotional and their psychological health, the sign of remorse showed by the other participants. Those are all the factors that you then say, do you blame the participant? From the legal perspective, it would be really, really a very steep hill to kind of climb, because these games, Aubrey, and to the listeners, they guided, well, boxing, they've got a specific legislation, which is the Boxing Act, but also these are also determined in accordance with the legal principles of law of deals. And it's very difficult to prove all the elements of, liability on the law of delict in this particular case. But obviously, there may be instances where the legal claim may succeed. And but then you also have to look across board of all the pertinent or the relevant stakeholders. So by that, I mean we've got to look at the participants themselves. We've got to look at the relevant governing bodies of that particular sport. We may have to look at the team or the club, and also the relevant association where applicable. So the possible liable parties will really differ from sport to sport, and also to incident to incident.
Give us a call, 011-883-0702. Have you been in a sporting accident or injury, and you are perhaps thinking about some of the, shall we say, the legal recourses that you have in this particular space? A child that perhaps played in a particular game and... yeah, you've been told it was an accident, but something in you says somebody got to pay. Where do you start? I'd be interested to hear from you on 011-883-0702. I suppose at a certain level, it makes sense that somebody could be told, I'm sorry, man, you can see this was an accident.
Yeah.
This was an accident, and accidents happen. And we can't hold anybody liable here because this was an accident. Would a family member or a parent be able to say, but no, I want to hold somebody accountable. I want to hold, for example, the Boxing South Africa accountable. I want to hold SARU accountable. Or I want to hold the coach accountable. I want to hold the school accountable. Is there space in our law for anybody who feels aggrieved in that way to do so, even though you and I, from an observer's point of view, could argue, this thing was an accident, man. This,
sure.
But is there room for somebody who feels that aggrieved in search of some sort of retribution to come out and say, I want legal recourse for retribution in this situation?
Okay. Yes. There is that possibility. So the chances of you succeeding as minimal as they are, one may be able to prove. Say, for an example, where the conduct of the other participants to the sporting game is so remarkably inconsistent with what would generally be expected in that particular sport. That's one example where then you may stand a chance to succeed. Or where the legal convictions of the society seriously reject or condemn that particular conduct of the wrongdoer. Or specifically with boxing, where the consent. Where the consent was withdrawn during the fight. In that particular instance, it's been withdrawn, and if the wrongdoer persists with the punches, and then there's a fatal punch in the process, then you then stand a very good chance. Or where the consent by the victim, was not legally granted or legally sought, then in that particular case, you do stand a chance to succeed. So it's in very limited instances, but there is that possibility as slim as it is.
Well, give me a call. I'd love to hear from you on 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567. Give me, in your experience, Mtor, some cases that some of us may be able to recognize where some of these principles would be applied.
Okay, Aubrey. Because how the sporting governing bodies, and for an example, soccer, your FIFA, they've got the internal processes, you know, and the guides in terms of how they go about doing these kinds of instances where there's been, you know, say a potential litigation that could emanate from the injuries or the sport injuries. So we really rarely see those cases go to court, and they are dealt with internally within the relevant bodies. But one that comes to mind, I was actually part of that particular case as a candidate attorney some 3 years back. It related to the amateur rugby game, and in that particular case, though I did not see it through to finality, we had a very good chance because we were able to demonstrate that the conduct of the wrongdoer was so remarkably inconsistent with what would generally be expected in the rugby setting. So I can always try and share the outcome of that particular case, but I will have to do my research in that regard.
Sure. I've got some documents here that speak of, for example, the Boxing Act 11 of 2001, which should be considered in conjunction with boxing regulations, right? Whenever dealing with issues related to boxing, right? Beyond the statutory regulations, there are various common law principles that find application. And naturally, these types of claims would be determined in accordance with the principle of law of delict. What does that mean, law of delict?
Okay, so law of delict really looks at, it's based on the common law, and our common law is based, originally from the Roman Dutch law.
Yep.
The principles that find applicable or are relevant for our discussion here when we talk about law of delict. So if I inflict some sort of injury to you, you may be then able to claim for damages for that particular injury. Sometimes law of delict also just relates to the monetary loss. Sometimes there is no physical infliction of harm, but you've lost, you know, in monetary terms. And in that case also, that should be that your case will be determined in line with the principles of law of delict. So generally, Aubrey, for law of delict, you as the victim, you've got to prove 5 natural elements of delict, which is wrongfulness, or you've got to prove that wrongful conduct and fault of someone else has caused you harm. So in that statement, as mentioned, the element of wrongfulness, conduct, fault, causation, and harm. And these 5 elements, they are quite elaborative. If we were to go to case law and we were to go to to the law books in terms of what they mean and what is really required to prove those. So all that comes to what we refer to as the common law principles of law of delict.
Give us a call. I'd love to hear from you. Any issues that you've had on the sporting field, on the field of play, where something happened that you believe was wrongful, or the conduct was not in line with, I suppose, the spirit of the game, or somebody was at fault, or you see some form of causation for a particular accident or something that happened there, or harm happened. Give me a call. I'd love to hear from you. These interesting principles, when I'm told, are very, very important because, you know, those of us who are lay to the law, tend to be guided by how we feel about something. So if I feel aggrieved about something, if I feel something has wronged me, if I feel like I've been wronged in one way or the other, I imagine sometimes that I have a legal case, right?
Yes, yeah.
But what I've come to learn with talking to you and many other friends of mine in the legal fraternity is that right and wrong in the legal sense has its own ways of being determined, right? And sometimes that may feel like the law is not on our side. So if my son, who plays soccer at school or whatever the case may be, is involved in an accident, is tackled wrongly, breaks his foot or whatever the case may be, and I feel deeply aggrieved because it's my son, I'm angry, and what should I be thinking in order for me to launch a legal case?
Sure, thanks for that question, because you really struggle with clients because when they come with a case that has to be of that nature, because they are aggrieved, and it's very difficult if you're in that state to be objective and to look at the facts and to kind of understand the logic behind these legal principles, because it's something so close to your heart. So you really have to rely on the legal opinion. And what I always advise people is if you are dissatisfied with or you are not happy with a certain legal opinion, by all means, you are at liberty to consult further. There may be, financial implications, for sorting all these different legal opinions. But at the end of the day, you do not want to sit with the situation where years later, where your claim probably has prescribed. By prescribed, I mean you are no longer in a position to institute your claim. Then it comes out that the legal opinion that you had received was wrong or was inaccurate, and therefore you've kind of lost your legal recourse in that sense. So the best way of doing it is to instead of involving your emotions, as difficult as it is, you've got to kind of allow your legal representatives to advise you and take the advice as is, because there are cost implications to these things. Sorry, it's cost that's involved, and litigation by its very nature, you will probably know this, takes lots of time and energy for you as the litigating party, and also for the lawyers. But at least for the lawyers, they are able to make money out of that time of litigation. So you really have to rely on your legal your legal representatives, and try to kind of disassociate your emotions from the legal case, because it's one thing to deal with the law and to deal with the emotions, because it clouds your judgment, it clouds your view of the case. And the best person or the best positioned person to give you the advice by default, it is your legal representative.
Let me take some calls. Anonymous is in Boksburg. Hi, Anonymous.
Hi, Aubrey.
Yeah, hi.
How are you?
I'm well, Anonymous. What's on your mind, Mama?
Yes. I feel like you are speaking to me. My child went to school, and he went to play soccer somewhere in the East End. So I just got a call to say, come to the hospital. There's an emergency. Your child was injured. Apparently, it's like he was playing soccer. So I don't know. It's like two other children, because now there's two versions. So it's like there was a child who crushed my child's head
mm-hmm.
because I didn't see the incident, but the injuries were quite serious. So
yeah.
Now, what I don't understand is that at first, my child was taken to the nearest hospital, which is a small hospital. And then now the parent is the one who took my child to the hospital. But anyway, when I got to the hospital, the teachers were there. I understand, you know, they paid. So now, because the hospital is too small, so they didn't have, like, all the specialists that my child needed. So ultimately, I ended up transferring my child from that small hospital to RVEC Hospital. So my child needed like four specialists. So now there is medical bills because he needed a maxilla facial specialist. And then there is another specialist who is dealing with, I don't know, the brain, neuro or something. And then now there is the dental and the eye specialist. So I feel like, I don't know, somebody must take responsibility. The coach, I want to know if this coach is registered. And it's like, and then the mother, the lady who actually took my child to the hospital was telling me that they were not happy with the sports facilities and the age group again. And then one of the children, because I interviewed, you know, some of the children, and then they were like, I don't know. It's like it didn't look like an accident because some people are saying it's an accident. And then some people are saying there was one child and then two children. I don't know. It's like
anonymously, let me say this.
Mm.
Your child got hurt here.
Yes.
And you are angry about that.
Yes, I am.
And you want answers.
I want answers.
And you want to hold somebody responsible for your child's injury?
Yes, from the department, the coach, the two schools. I want to see, like, because this woman told, the mother told me that the ground for the sporting facilities, it was as if they were playing in, you know.
How's your child now?
He's still, you know, he's still, I can't say he underwent surgery.
Hmm.
So, yeah.
All right. Let's hear what Ntokozisi has to say. Nto, so at an emotional level, I understand what Anonymous is going through. Talk to us about the legalities.
Okay, Abish. So I hear she refers to the facility, the conditions of the facility, and she also mentioned about the coach also and all those related things and people. I think Obi to be able to give or kind of guide in this instance. It really depends. We've got to a very close scrutiny of the incident. To me, it sounds, you know, the way there have been so many medical experts here. There is a neurosurgeon involved. There is, I think she mentioned the medulla facial, the expert in that regard, and also the injuries, the nature and the extent seems a bit extreme, and I did not get the age group of the participants also. It sounds more remarkably inconsistent, if I can refer back to my earlier statement. The conduct is a bit of, remarkably inconsistent with what should generally be expected to be the injury from the soccer game. But to be able to pin liability to anyone, it would really, I do not know if there is a video for that. But also then, who do you say instructed the other participant to inflict harm of that nature, then it becomes.
It appears to me, if I can just jump in there, Mtor, that first we need to hold somebody liable, right? In this particular case, and anonymous, and again, I get the emotion. I get it. I'm a parent. I get how a parent would be angry at this situation. But I think she, like me, is struggling to really zoom in as to who is directly liable and culpable for whatever case you may want to launch. To get some sort of retribution. Is it the coach? Is it the kid? Is it the parent of the kid that allegedly injured the child? Is it the department? Is it the school? Is it the teachers? Who would she direct her anger to by way of litigation and holding somebody liable?
For sure, Aubrey. The difficulty here, I think, is what would anyone responsible for the match do to prevent that kind of injury?
Yeah,
because this injury was inflicted by the other participant. Then it's very difficult to. If for an example, there was some kind of. Maybe a dangerous weapon that was hidden or in the on the ground, and it kind of cut the child whilst running or falling down. Then you can say the school or whoever is responsible for the playing grounds should have done their due diligence to ensure there is nothing that poses a threat or a risk, to the players. In this particular instance, it's the infliction of harm by the other participant.
Yeah.
The other parties or the other relevant role players, what could they do to avoid that? So it's a bit tricky.
I hear you. Anonymous, will you listen for Togo Zisi's contact details? Maybe you can then at some point sit down with him and really talk about your case, because I think that your case may need other interventions other than legal interventions.
I also wanted to clarify something, because the mother who called me was like, they were not happy with the, the sporting facility. She doesn't even understand why they agreed to play in that kind of a field.
Sure.
I
understand. And all of those are the merits of the case that you would then need to speak to somebody in Togozis' position. But will you listen to his contact details and maybe just get in touch with him and just talk as to what are the legal parameters that are available to you and the options that are also available to you in this space. But my sense, Anonymous, is that you, your child, and maybe even your whole family have gone through something very, very traumatic. That beyond the legal issues that are at play here, there are other issues that you guys need to deal with, because I think that you've been traumatized quite seriously by this particular issue. And I hope that you'll seek the help in that regard. Anonymous in Boksburg, much appreciated. Selma is in Roodepoort. Hi.
Hello, Aubrey. I have something interesting. I'll be very quick.
Yep.
First one is, if your child says that he's got flu and he says, then I'm fine, Mom, I still want to go and play rugby, whatever, tennis, doesn't matter.
Yep.
You're not believing, because when you get flu, your muscles and things get sore. But what people don't realize is the heart is a muscle.
Yeah.
And if you should overexert it while you've got flu, you can get a heart attack.
Yeah.
It happened to a friend of my son's. He decided, he was all of a sudden going to play in the first team. It was such an honor. And he said, now, I can't miss this first game.
Mm.
He actually had a heart attack, I think he was only 16, on the field.
Oh, my word. Heart attack.
So, Yes, heart attack. From when he had flu.
Oh, my word.
What people don't realize, do not let your children go and play contact sports.
They're running
around when they have flu, because it affects your muscles, including your heart.
Including your heart, of course. Your heart is a muscle, please. Yeah.
I'm begging the people, please, you know, otherwise you're going to be losing your children. And another one is that often principals think they can force kids into playing contact sports like rugby, where you can get quite badly injured, break necks and all that sort of thing, and, you know, become paraplegic and so on. So I know once in the school that my son was in high school, they decided, I know we're going to take the kids out of the chess team and force them to play that. Well, luckily I was on the committee of the Western Chess Association at the time, so I very quickly threatened the headmaster with reporting to CHESA. Well, that sorted that out very quickly. But, you know, that is just not the done thing. You cannot force people to play contact sports that they know they could get injured in, that they are not interested in playing in. It is not as if it's something you have to pass.
Yeah.
You pass the trip or something, and I think that is really bad. So anyway, that's all my contribution for tonight. And thanks for loving
Selma, much again. Appreciated. Thank you so much. And it's true, you know, sometimes we as parents live our lives vicariously through our children, and we then put pressure on our children to take part in certain sports and all sorts of different things. And I think Selma is giving some sage advice there, that please, especially when there's a flu or a cold or something of that nature, it's the body saying, give me a break. And you then expose your child on to that kind of thing. I remember somebody asking me to have a conversation about that at some level, about how we can calm some parents down. You go to your child's, I mean, the under 9D, the under 9D soccer game. And then you'll see dad going crazy. I mean, crazy. The under 9D soccer game. Dad's ready to fight parents and the coach and the linesman. It's crazy. So we do need to have that conversation. So Mtor, some of the questions coming through here. Jack Pagati says, hello, Brobs. Please ask your guest if those forms that indemnifies the school when our kids go play sport for the school are valid. Are those kinds of indemnity pieces of paper valid in any way?
To a very limited extent. I think now the law has kind of allowed us to be able to maneuver in many ways around the indemnities. They do not hold much value. So as much as the schools and the other institutions still do see the need to have those signed. It's quite possible. We do that almost all the time to find a way around those. Yeah.
Somebody sends me this message. Says Anonymous needs to clarify whether her child was injured inside the field of play or off the ground. This you can establish by questioning those who were at the ground. If the injury happened inside the field of play, then she can look at the opponent who injured him for blame. The only problem is that the other party will then claim he lacked the fault principle of delict, i.e. intention to injure or carelessly injuring the other party. Another one says, another good example is in a situation where a player collapses in a FIFA-sanctioned game. In terms of FIFA rules, a deliberator is required to be available in the field as part of first aid. If a player can die because there was a need for it to be administered, and it is discovered it was not available, then there is a legitimate claim for non-compliance as a cause for death, says Lucky in Pretoria East. So clearly, Mto, there are some very, very technical issues that need to be underscored here when dealing with legalities that pertain to gripes that we might have on the playing field. So, for example, Martin Coleman says, Orbs, shouldn't there be intent to do harm or negligence by someone for someone to be held liable? And how do you measure that in contact sport? And I suppose that's what the law of delict is. The Mtokozisi, that you'd need to be able to prove certain technical issues before you can even claim to have a case.
Yes, that is so. And I think he's right to point out on negligence, because if you recall earlier on, I did allude to five elements of diligence.
Yeah.
Negligence falls under fault, the element of fault. So fault comes in two forms or shapes, being the negligence, or it may be intentional. So I do agree. That is absolutely 100%. And also, Audrey, you are quite right to say it's very technical. You've got to look beyond your laws of general application. For example, your common law principle relating to the law of duty and the Act. You've got to look at the sporting code, and also the code of conduct applicable for that particular sport. And you look at the constitution of the governing bodies of that particular sporting code. So then the legal principles, you draw them from all these various legal instruments. Then that can really be technical, and then you've got to come to the conclusion as to whether there is liability or not.
And I suppose that's the big question in all of the conversations that we have about our anger at load shedding, at Palapala games. All the anger that we feel justifiably at an emotional level because we have been aggrieved here and we want somebody to be held liable. At some point, we need to satisfy certain legal principles in order for us to get legal recourse. Yeah? Game two?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I kind of lost your contact there.
No, the reason why I'm actually throwing that aspect in is because I'm angry. I'm angry about the fact that we are in stage six.
Justifiably so, yes.
Yeah. I'm angry about not getting answers about what happened at the president's house. I'm angry about that. I'm angry about all sorts of different things. I'm angry about the children that died yesterday or the day before. Yeah. I'm angry about a lot of things. But what I'm getting out of this conversation is that anger alone, for the purpose of getting legal recourse, is not enough. We need to subject ourselves to the process of thinking about how do we connect our anger to a legal principle in order for us to get legal recourse?
That is absolutely correct. The emotions and the law sometimes, well, in most instances, are not compatible. And we need to kind of disassociate one from the other. And in so doing, then we actually put ourselves in a better condition, position rather, to say, do we put our money in this, because court cases come at a very, very, huge sum of money and also time. I mean, those are the two major considerations when you decide to take on the case. As much as certain things are really, close to our heart and all that, it's very important to be objective and to look at this from that perspective. Yes.
How do we get in touch with you, Tor? Particularly for Anonymous, who really has some deep questions to ask.
Yeah, no, I would be very happy for you to reach out. I think we can discuss the potential case further. So it's my name, Mtokozisi, my surname being Mapumulo at adams.africa, you can call 012-432-6293. Or you can just go to the website page of Adams & Adams and you can search for my name, Tom Mapumulo, and you will find all the details.
Always great talking to you.